Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Martha Burke. She is a political psychologist and nationally recognized authority on women's issues. She's the money editor of Ms. Magazine, and she's author of the new book, Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. So, first of all, how significantly different is the women's vote from the men's vote?
It's quite significant, and it varies from election to election. But we've known since 1980, when the infamous gender gap was discovered, that women vote differently from men.
Now, we didn't have a gender gap before that, or we just didn't know about it?
We didn't really have a significant gender gap before then. You know, when women got the vote way back in 1920, a lot of folks said, why give women the vote? They're just going to vote like their husbands anyway. And it turned out to be true for quite a few years, not all the way up to 1980, but for a number of years. And women didn't register to vote even after getting that important franchise. They didn't go out and register in the numbers people thought. But by 1980, three things happened. It was a perfect storm. Women outnumbered men in the population. Women outnumbered men in voter registration, and they outnumbered men in turnout, and they voted differently. Ronald Reagan won the election that year, but women did not vote for him in near the numbers that men did. So that's when the term gender gap was coined, and it's never gone away.
So they weren't actually able to swing the election to the Democrat, Jimmy Carter, but the majority of them did vote for Carter.
That's right. The majority of women voted for Carter, majority of men voted for Reagan. It's been true in every election since. The parties themselves are becoming divided into a men's party and a women's party. Now, we're not near there yet, but if you look at how voters identify, a lot of folks are now identifying as independents, women and men. But more women identify as Democrats, more men identify as Republicans. That is a trend that is continuing.
It's so interesting that after the women's liberation movement, as it was called, of the 60s and 70s, that a voting gender gap emerged. It seems like the liberation was really a liberation of mind, where they decided to vote, you know, what they actually thought rather than what maybe their partners or male figures in their lives were doing.
That's exactly right. Women sort of came of age politically in the 1970s, and it hasn't changed. Women now, yeah, they might listen to their husband, but when they go in that voting booth, they're going to vote the way they think their interests lie. And as I'm fond of saying, women can now control any election, and they need to be thinking that way. We need to be thinking that way because the outcomes are so important. This year's election may be the most important in a generation in terms of outcomes for women and the men that care about them.
And as you say in your book, every election people say this may be the most, but this one really might be.
Why? Well, because the next president, for one thing, is going to get a minimum of two court appointments.
We're talking about the Supreme Court appointments,
unless trends of the past don't hold. But two of the liberal members, John Paul Stevens and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the only woman on the court, are up there in age. Certainly in the next 8 years, it's highly likely that one or both of them would leave the court, and very possibly in the next 4 years. We've already seen in this last 4 years what court appointments can do. John Roberts and Samuel Alito are the two newest members of the court. They swung the vote against a woman, Lilly Ledbetter, very recently on a pay equity case.
And that's a shocking case. You talk about this in your book.
That is a shocking case. She was a woman who had worked for Goodyear Tire and Rubber for over 15 years. And she found out after 15 years that she had been being paid less than the men all along. And these were men that that had her same experience or less experience. And at some point, she even had trained several of these men. And she was just being systematically paid less for the exact same job. And she found out about it by accident. And so she sued. And the court overturned 40 years of precedent. It said to her, Lily Ledbetter, yeah, you were discriminated against, and it was wrong for the company to do that. But you had to file your lawsuit within 6 months of that very first short paycheck, or you don't have a case.
But she didn't know about it.
But she didn't know about it. It was absolutely a catch-22. And courts all the way from the 1960s, when the Equal Pay Act was passed, and 64, the Civil Rights Act, they've always said, you have 6 months from the day you find out you're being shorted. But Roberts and Alito led the charge and said, no, you have 6 months from that very first short paycheck. Women many times don't know about it and many times can be fired if they ask some other worker what they're making.
So what was behind that decision? I mean, just pure out sexism?
Well, there was some sexism to it, but I think it was a pro-corporate mindset. You know, when those two judges were elevated to the Supreme Court, many people said it's going to be the end of Roe v. Wade. It's going to be the end of abortion rights. But some people also said these are very pro-corporate judges and it could be the end to employment rights for women and people of color. And I think it's that as much as it is a sort of latent sexism that we often find in the judiciary.
What are some other Supreme Court decisions in the 20th century and more recently that have affected, for better and worse, the lives of women?
Well, the lives of women of color, of course, and their children have been affected by the recent decision that doesn't exactly overturn Brown v. the Board of Education, but it does curtail what school districts can do in trying to achieve a racial balance in their schools. So that is something. The United States Congress passed and President Bush signed the first federal abortion ban in history in recent years, and the court upheld it. It's not an outright ban, but it is a ban on one certain abortion procedure, which many advocates believe it's sort of opening the door to more and more restrictions, if not an outright overturn. And so this court did uphold that law.
On the other side, there is Roe v. Wade that did give women the right to have an abortion in the first place.
Right. Roe v. Wade was decided in the 1970s, and what Roe actually did was extract the right to abortion from the right to privacy. There is no right to abortion in the United States Constitution, but the court said it was implied in the right to privacy. But what has happened since then is that it's been chipped away by various court decisions that require notification, certain things that doctors have to say to women, waiting periods, and that sort of thing. So it's making it harder and harder to actually obtain an abortion, whereas it's still technically legal.
We're talking to Martha Burke. So let's review how far we've come legally and socially since we got the right to vote, which was less than 100 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, 1920. What strides have we made and where are we still lacking?
Well, we have a lot of legal rights now. We cannot be fired for being pregnant. We have the right to be free, supposedly, from discrimination in pay and promotion. Now, this latest court decision, as I said, has curtailed the right to redress for that. But employers still cannot discriminate on the basis of gender. You know, we used to see ads in the paper that said help wanted women, help wanted men. And employers would say, well, we don't hire women for that job. Or they could legally say, we pay women less than we pay men for that job. Women can now get their own credit without having a man, any man, sign the papers. You know, lenders used to say, well, you have to have a man. What if you're not married? Well, get your brother, get your grandfather. Gee, get the janitor. I don't know. You have to have a man. We've overcome all of that.
We've also overcome the mindset that says that that makes any sense at all.
Well, we hope so. We hope so. We still have a few folks around that think women should not have equal opportunity in employment, our military being the poster child for that. There's still lots of folks that think not only should women not be in the military, but if they are, their ability to serve in certain jobs is limited. But where I wanted to go with this is we got all those legal rights. We now have equal access to education. At the time women got the vote, they couldn't get in universities simply because they were women. Couldn't go to law school, medical school, universities at all. But now that doesn't happen anymore. However, all of our rights are statutory, meaning they're just one law at a time. Title VII, Title IX, equal credit, pregnancy discrimination, and on down the line. That can all be overturned by a hostile Congress. And where we have not made the progress is we still don't have equal rights in the United States Constitution.
Now, that we would have if the Equal Rights Amendment had been passed.
That's right. There was a 10-year effort to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. It has to be approved by two-thirds of the states. It missed by three states back in the early 1980s being ratified. And so some people think that if we got three more states, we would have equal rights. Others think we would have to start the ratification drive all over. It is an open constitutional question.
There's still a pay gap between men and women. What's going on? I mean, is it the Supreme Court case that you just mentioned is a case where women were getting paid less for doing the exact same job, but there's also the issue of comparable worth. So somebody in a traditionally women's job like teaching is going to be making less than somebody in a traditionally men's job.
Well, there's that. That's job segregation, where the so-called men's jobs traditionally paid more. A plumber usually makes more than a teacher, and that has been traditionally a male job. So that goes all the way back to when we thought of women working for pin money, or they wanted to buy a washing machine or another TV, so the little woman would go to work to make that extra money, and her jobs were devalued. Of course, that's no longer the case. Most women are, almost half the workforce is female now. And most women are working. Most women, some women at the lower end, are working a couple of jobs to support their family. So this idea that women are working for extra money is wrong. But we still find that mindset. Take teaching, which you mentioned, or nursing. Both of these are traditionally female jobs, but do you know that men in those jobs make more than the women?
Is that right?
Yes.
How can that be?
Well, again, women are still told, even in this day and age, men have to support their families, and so they need to make more. Enlightened employers don't do it, but there's still that mindset out there. And we have found that just plain old sex discrimination informs a lot of employment decisions. Young people coming out of college, the women will be hired right now at about 80% of what the young men are getting for the same job coming out of college. Well, when that happens, that pay gap follows you all your life because you're behind to start with.
Right. Now, it's interesting because when you live in a country like ours where we don't have maternity leave, we don't have support for women, it does fall on men, if you have a traditional married couple with children, to support the family because there's no other support.
Well, it's interesting to think about how the pay gap folds into the other issues such as paid family leave. And we are the only industrialized country that does not have some kind of paid pregnancy leave or paid family leave, meaning you could take it for a sick child or elderly parent, something like that, and get paid. Other countries in the industrialized world have it. We don't. But what happens when a kid does get sick, and let's say it's an illness that is going to require recuperation of, say, a month. Somebody has to take off work. Now, just plain economics will tell you the family suffers less economically if the lower earner takes off work because the family doesn't lose as much money. The lower earner is usually the woman. So what happens? She takes off because she has to, because it's best for her family. Then the employer says, well, she's not a serious worker. Gee, the first time a kid gets sick, she's not going to be here. I better not promote her. Or the people who aren't taking off work, they get the good reports in. Maybe they bring in another client, whatever. So they're seen as real go-getters while this woman has lost out.
And that's a common story.
That is a common story. And we see women who are forced to take off due to family circumstances. If the pay gap were reversed and men made less, I'm sure we'd see many more men being forced into that situation.
Now, are women still, I mean, I know the answer to this already, but women are still choosing between family and career. Have you ever met a man who framed his life that way? I just am having trouble making the choice between whether to have kids with my wife or whether to have a job, whether to have a career.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have never personally met a man that said to me, I'm trying to decide whether to have a career or family. What we know, and again, this is some built-in sexism to our culture, is that being married and having a family is a career enhancer for men. They're seen as more steady, more secure workers. They're going to be on the job. Being married and having a family is seen as a detriment to women workers. A lot of employers, it's illegal to ask a prospective employee, do you plan to have children? But a lot of employers are sitting there looking at a young woman across the table, maybe thinking, well, she's going to get pregnant in 2 years and leave. I better not hire her.
And that's still going on, even though it's illegal.
Yeah, well, what's the illegal part is the asking out loud. What people are thinking, and they're not going to tell the person, well, I'm not hiring you because you're female. That is illegal. But they may convince themselves even, well, she's less qualified or her courses in college were not quite what his were or something like that.
Now, I think what happens is a lot of people have this mindset that this is just the natural order of things. But that's sort of, I mean, when you start looking at other countries, European countries and so on, you see that they don't think that way.
No, they don't. And Sweden is a perfect example. Sweden has paid family leave, and they have use it or lose it for both parents. Now, this doesn't do much for the single parent, be it a female or male, but for a married couple, they're entitled to so many weeks paid leave. But you can't put it all on one spouse. If they're going to get the full paid leave, both spouses have to take their share. And that is a way to equalize the workload at home, to equalize the burden on employers, and to just make a fairer shake for both parties.
So basically, you have, in that case, public policy really going into the home and saying, guess what, ladies and gentlemen, you both have to do dishes and change
yeah,
diapers.
Exactly. And is that a good thing? I think the outcome is very good because what it does is change the culture. You know, I often say that, back to our earlier conversation, the challenge in the 1970s was to change the law. The challenge now is to change the culture. And I think we are seeing something of a backlash against working women, that employers are getting bolder in passing over working women for promotion, for example. And, you know, to reach beyond the working years, this stuff goes all your life because Social Security, for example, is women's main retirement. And if you make less or have to drop out of the workforce during your working years, your Social Security is going to be lower in your retirement years.
We're talking to Martha Burke. She is author of the book Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. It's interesting that you say in the 1970s the focus was so much on changing the laws and not changing the culture. It seems like with the, I mean, you know, from my point of view, looking back to that time, that there was such a focus with the civil rights movements and the ecological movement and the women's movement and so on, and, you know, black power. And so, I mean, everybody, it was like a movement to change the culture, to make a culture of peace and ecological balance and so on. And the 60s were about changing the culture to, you know, with some might argue limited success, some might argue a lot of success.
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about racism, environmentalism, or sexism, in my view. I think the civil rights movement of the 1960s was the most important movement of all the movements that were going on at the time. And the civil rights movement was about the rights of racial minorities, women and men. But it turned out to be mostly about the personhood of black men. And I don't just sit here as a white person saying that. Dorothy Height, who's head of the National Council of Negro Women, who was the only woman allowed on the stage at the Lincoln Memorial for the I Have a Dream speech, and she was not allowed to speak. And she said she had to really fight to just get on the stage, the only woman, says there was no question who was the boss of the house in those days in the black community, and it has not changed that much. So what we have learned is, as a country and a culture, that while racism is far from eradicated, culturally we know it's wrong, we know certain things we don't say publicly, we don't say things that are pejorative and hurtful. Because it's wrong. And we learned that as a culture from the civil rights movement. But we didn't learn the same thing about sexism.
It's very interesting because there is such a, when you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, he talks about the emasculation of the black man. And so there is a very much of a gender dynamic involved with the whole liberation movement.
There's very much a gender dynamic, and the women's liberation movement, if you will, came out of the civil rights movement because women were relegated to servants and sleepers, if you will. They were expected to be sexually available, to get the coffee, to do the support stuff, and they were treated as second-class citizens.
And being trained by their 1950s mothers, it came pretty naturally unless they started to fight it.
They did. And so the civil rights movement did, in a certain way, give birth to the second wave of the women's movement, just as the anti-slavery movement gave birth to the first wave of the women's movement when they got the vote. And how did that happen? It was because there were a lot of abolitionist women who were not allowed to speak at the meetings. They went to a major meeting over in England and had to sit in the balcony behind curtains. And they said, what is this about? You know, we are fighting for the rights of slaves, but yet we ourselves don't have the franchise. We have to sit behind a curtain. And so the suffrage movement came out of that. So they've been intertwined all along. But back to the point, and the example I use, although there are so many coming out of the political season, the primary fights, Hillary Clinton was in the primaries as a major contender. A person in John McCain's audience asked in front of the television cameras and radio microphones, how are we going to beat that bitch? McCain did not react to that phrasing. He did not call out the questioner and say that's an inappropriate question to ask. We need to concentrate on our agenda, and I won't entertain that kind of question. Now, imagine if she had asked the same thing about Obama using the N-word. I do not think that
McCain
would have ignored it.
She would have been publicly crucified on the Washington Mall.
She absolutely would have been, and McCain would have spoken out right then and said, that's totally inappropriate. I won't answer that question.
Right. We're talking to Martha Burke. So let's talk about the political situation that we find ourselves in. Women are more liberal than men, and Democratic women are more liberal than Democratic men. What's this about? And first of all, what do we even mean by liberal? And I think it's interesting because it's one of those words like feminist that, you know, you say, oh, well, that's not what I am until you define it. And then you say, oh, yeah, I'm kind of that.
Well, it is interesting. And to use the feminist word, when you ask people if they're a feminist, about half of them will say yes. without any qualification. But then if you say, well, do you believe in the political, social, and economic equality between the sexes, about 95% say yes.
And so basically their 95% are actually dictionary definition feminists.
Yes, exactly. But women and men do think differently about priorities. And just to take the three big ones in the current election, the war, the economy, and health care, those are the top three issues for both women and men. But there are significant gender gaps in how people feel about it. 10% more women than men say the war is their top priority. On the economy...
Now, ending the war, specifically.
Ending the war. On the economy, 6% of women say that is the top issue. I mean, 6% more. There's a significant gender gap there. And women worry about different things. Women worry about losing their own jobs, their benefits. Are their kids going to lose their jobs in a lot of cases? Men tend to worry a little bit more about the stock market, interest rates, and sort of the bigger picture. And that is because their jobs in general are more secure and their jobs in general provide more benefits. That is why women are a lot more worried about solving the health care problems than men, because more men have coverage at work. They're not worried about losing it. Women do not have coverage. We have 40 million people in this country with no coverage, and the majority are women and their children.
Now, not to talk about sexist stereotypes here, but, you know, one wonders whether women aren't just naturally a little more empathetic.
Well, I think we've all been taught that women are more empathetic, and when you have that caretaker role, that reinforces it. So I think that that is probably true. When you ask open-ended questions, you know, what, and don't give a laundry list, but you just ask people, what's an important thing to you in terms of priorities for the country? Women will often say helping the poor or helping people who don't have enough to eat. Men do mention it, but not with the frequency. So your observation is probably right.
We're talking to Martha Burke. There seems to be a gap between how voters are represented in the media and by their politicians versus how they actually feel themselves on the issues that you are mentioning. So when politicians and the media talk about Iraq and global warming and the economy and so on, it seems like they're not really representing the people.
Well, what I try to say in my book, and I try to give people questions to actually ask the politicians, because we hear too much double talk, we hear generalities, we hear words that don't have meaning for us. We hear, well, I want to do something that is responsible and benefits everyone in the country, when they're talking about affirmative action, for example, as I heard this afternoon on the radio. What does that mean? Does that mean you are for keeping affirmative action programs or you're not for it? And what is affirmative action? Why do you call it a quota when quotas are against the law? These are the kinds of details that I want women voters and men who care about the women in their lives to think about. You know, people think affirmative action is a racial quota program. Actually, affirmative action has gotten more jobs for women of all races, and it has allowed women to advance in the workplace to a much greater extent than people realize. It's made a huge difference in getting women in medical schools, in law schools, and in jobs when they come out. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, our only Supreme Court justice, when she came out of law school, she couldn't get a job because she was a woman.
Right.
Affirmative action has helped that. So we need to nail these politicians on the words they're using and make them explain what do you mean by that.
I think also when you – I mean, this is a – there's – in everything we're talking about, there's so much crossover between legal change and social change. So when you have women coming out of law school, they can't get a job. Then you have affirmative action. They can get a job. A generation later, whether it's a man or woman doing the hiring, those stereotypes about whom you can give a job to in the first place just aren't there, and you start looking at the candidates in a more unprejudiced way.
Well, I think that is true to a certain degree in terms of who can get hired. because women, and this is a reason that younger women don't see the urgency of the so-called women's issues or the women's movement, because they now are number one in colleges, both in enrollment and in grades, and they can get hired. Where the discrimination catches up is later in that workplace where stereotypes kick in. You know, what I am fond of saying, because I believe this is true, I think the reason younger women don't feel it to the same degree is the educational system is the last meritocracy they will ever operate in their lives. You make good grades, you excel in school, you get rewarded for it. Once you get out in the workplace, there are many other factors, good old boyism, just outright prejudice. A lot of things factor into that. The workplace is not an outright meritocracy.
To say the least, where was I reading? You were active in integrating a golf club, and golf is one of those places where the boys' club exists most strongly and most powerfully in so many important circles.
Well, it does. It's like an outdoor annex to the corporate boardrooms. And the controversy you're speaking of was over the Augusta National Golf Club, the premier golf club in the United States, if not the world, and it does not allow women. And when I was head of the National Council of Women's Organizations, I led a charge to open that club to women, not to play golf, but for the business opportunities. We were not successful in that. The boys stood together, and they're CEOs of some of America's largest corporations, such as American Express, Citigroup, Prudential, Sara Lee, and others. And what we found was, goes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of how people view sexism and sex discrimination as opposed to racial discrimination. Had it been an all-white club and this secret membership, which it was at the time, came out of who are these members, and it happened to be the Fortune 500, they couldn't have beat each other out the door fast enough to resign. But because it was gender discrimination and not race, they all said, well, we don't see anything wrong with it. We stand together, and we're going to reinforce this this gender discrimination. Now, I do have to add that what we have done as a women's organization, and I'm still a consultant to the National Council, is we've helped some women sue some of these corporations for sex discrimination, and to date they have collected over $79 million.
We're talking to Martha Burke, the author of Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. Now, you were mentioning that in your book, it's very much of an activist handbook, among other things. There's questions at the end of the chapters for people to use, questions to ask their politicians. What are the forums in which people can actually use these questions?
Well, there are several, and this is where the electronic age is really helpful. You can, of course, go to town hall meetings, and they'll all be holding town hall meetings. And I would say that at your local and state level as well as national, because what happens nationally definitely trickles down to your local and state level in terms of how much money, for example, is going to be available for various state and local programs. So go to town hall meetings. Write to your local paper, but electronically, many of them now have websites where you can go in and ask the candidate a question. And whether the candidate personally is going to answer that is certainly problematic. Probably they won't. But the people who are taking care of that function for the candidate are darn sure reporting what kind of questions are coming in.
And so, when you ask those questions, it makes a difference does it make a difference? Have you seen the asking of questions make a difference?
I have seen something like it in calls to Congress, because I spent a lot of years in Washington, D.C., and here's what I know. If a bill is coming up for a vote and the congresswoman or congressman starts getting calls, the person taking that call is not probably going to listen to a whole lot of the substance of what the caller says, but they are keeping up with a tally. How many calls did you get today? How many emails that want you to vote for this bill or vote against it? And they definitely pay attention to that.
Right. Now, there are some issues that you talk about in your book that are not real issues, sort of bait and switch, things that are used to distract people. What are some examples of those?
Well, flag burning. You know, I often say in speeches, I ask for a show of hands in the audience. How many people woke up this morning worried that somebody was going to burn a flag? And people laugh because it's just not on their radar screen. Now, when they sit down and think about it, some people feel very strongly that we should never burn a flag. Others that we should have that First Amendment right to burn a flag. Regardless, it is not a major issue for voters. Tort reform. You often hear lawsuits are out of control. We've got to do something about this lawsuit abuse. Well, if you ask people, they will say, I'm much more worried about corporate abuse and tainted products than I am about somebody suing a corporation for a faulty medical device that kills people. But bottom line is neither side of that issue is very much on voters' minds. There are others. You know, they say gays, guns, and abortion, the hot-button issues. Banning gay marriage. The conservative side of the political spectrum has been very successful in getting ballot initiatives out there to ban gay marriage. But if you ask voters an open-ended question about how important that is as a priority for the country, somewhere around 1 or 2% will mention it. Other people do not think that is a priority for the country, and they do not want the Congress to spend its time on gay marriage, trying to ban gay marriage. The same thing for building a fence along the border. Now, most people in the country want the immigration problem solved. They don't say immigration is not important. They want it solved. They want a way for people to become citizens if they've been here working, and they want a responsible solution. Pay your fine, pay your dues, learn English, keep your job, and become a citizen. But if you ask people, how important is building a fence, you almost get laughed at. Yet, politicians will take that as a major issue and say, oh, we have to solve this immigration problem by building a fence.
You know, when you talk about the three you just said together, gays, guns, and abortions, it does really point to the extent to which conservative politics and conservative thinking is based in a certain kind of machismo. You know, the gay issue blending, you know, gender roles not being as defined as they should be. Guns, that's the macho thing. Abortion, a woman's role is to have babies. You know, that's a subtext that doesn't probably get talked about enough.
It doesn't get talked about enough. And one thing that I think voters are not aware of, and I try to point out some of this lesser known things in my book, talking about gender roles, is we are now moving back towards sex-segregated schools. And the reason that is happening is a tiny provision in No Child Left Behind that now allows it to be legal to sex segregate schools and classrooms. It's been illegal since Title IX was passed in the 1970s. But it was overturned in a little provision in No Child Left Behind.
That not a single person who voted on it probably even noticed.
They probably did not even notice. Well, now what is happening, there was a districts all over the country are doing it with no evidence that it really works better to educate kids. And a lot of advocates are concerned. I mean, when you get out of school, you certainly have to work and live with the opposite sex, so it doesn't make a lot of sense to segregate kids. But one school district in Louisiana was very blatant about it, and they said boys need to learn to slay things and go out and hunt, and girls need to learn to take care of babies. And that is why we officially are segregating our schools. Thank goodness for one girl and her family who were highly offended by this, and they enlisted the American Civil Liberties Union to threaten a lawsuit, and the district backed down. But this is the kind of thinking that is creeping back into the schools due to this obscure provision of No Child Left Behind.
Now, why the hostility toward really taking care of the needs of women and families in the United States you know, as we've talked about, childcare, maternity leave, sick leave, health care in general. You're a psychologist. We don't have this, as we discussed in Sweden. Why do we have it so strongly and so persistently here?
Well, I think that there's been a conservative drumbeat for over 30 years now to educate the public that we all ought to stand on our own two feet, you know, self-reliance and so forth. Well, what does that mean? It means that there is no collective responsibility for anything. And child care is a very good example. We have been taught that child care is an individual family problem. To the extent that I had a young mother ask me in a forum, well, but if we had child care, would I have to send my child to a government center? And I said, yeah, if you want to think of universal daycare as a government center, you can think of it that way, just as the public schools could be thought of as a government school,
right?
Because they're supported by our tax dollars.
Or when you call the police, that's a government agent coming out to.
Exactly. Is a government agent going to come to my door? Well, yeah, if you're getting robbed, you could look at it that way. But I think the conservatives have been very, very successful in selling this mindset of personal responsibility beyond the point where it is good for society. You know, even liberals agree that everybody should try to work and do their part to contribute. You're not going to find any liberals that say people shouldn't work, people shouldn't be responsible to their families. But you're going to find very few conservatives that say society has an obligation to its citizens.
Well, and it's interesting because when you actually analyze the responsibilities that every person agrees on, it is things like police and firefighting and you know, the maintenance of roads and so on. And that's where our taxes go. And I think people really forget that, you know, all these things, you know, the word entitlements is used as if it's a negative word. But all of these things, they're just, we all paid into a pool. And, you know, and then it's getting spent to give back to the people.
Well, and I think taxes are going to be very important in the upcoming election because the two major candidates differ fundamentally on how taxes should be collected and how they should be spent. President Bush, as we all know by now, put in some very drastic tax cuts for the very wealthy. The Republican candidate, John McCain, would like to keep those tax cuts. He's reversed his position on it. Senator Obama says, no, we need to cut taxes on the middle class and the poorer people, and we need to do away with that huge tax cut that George Bush gave to the rich. And another thing that you're going to hear a difference at the congressional level particularly is some people are going to say, well, I'm for a flat tax, or I'm for, some of them call it a fair tax. The fair tax is anything but fair. It is a very regressive tax.
Is the fair tax synonymous with the flat tax?
Yes, and it means that low-income people are going to be paying taxes on every penny they take in, because they're going to be using that to buy food, gasoline, and the other necessities. And the wealthy people will be paying tax on very little of their income because they don't go out and spend it all. So the taxes of the income they make from investments won't be taxed at all under the so-called flat tax.
So let's go back to the subtitle of your book, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. One of the issues you mentioned is Social Security, which women draw on a lot more than men.
Women do draw on it more than men. It is women's main retirement. A shocking statistic, but an accurate one, from the U.S. government itself, is that without Social Security, over half of our elderly women would be living in poverty. That is shocking. You will get candidates, however, that will tell you, well, we need to privatize the system. We need to let people put their money in their own investments and not worry about having a universal retirement system. Well, what happens to women in that? First of all, there is no protection whatsoever in case of a divorce or death of a spouse. If it's all in a private account, the spouse can leave it to anyone he chooses. Leave it to a girlfriend, an old acquaintance, anyone. If there's a divorce, it's to be fought over just like the dog in the television set. There is no guarantee. Social Security is guaranteed for life. You cannot outlive it. And, you know, for the younger people out there who think, well, this is just an old person's issue, think again. If your mother or grandmother is drawing Social Security and all the whole system is privatized and she doesn't make very good investments and loses all that money, who's going to take care of her? You are. You're going to be writing a check every month. So think about that if you're a young person. It's not just an old person's issue.
I think it brings up a philosophical issue that I would hope that eventually gets talked about more, which is what things are appropriately private and what things are appropriately public. What is appropriate for nonprofit? What is appropriate for profit? You know, when a lot of prisons were privatized, the issue came up. When healthcare is private and it's for profit, the issue comes up. But I think we need to talk about this. This is a women's issue and a people's issue. When, you know, what should be for profit? What should be private?
Well, it's a profound question, and it's not something that has a, as they say in legal parlance, a bright line. There are some things, clearly who you have in your home and what you do in your home is totally private as long as you're not committing violence on another family member. See, that's where the gray area, I mean, we used to think of violence against women as a strictly family
right.
matter. Now, healthcare and the role of the private sector in healthcare is very much in the debate. Should there even be a profit motive in healthcare? This is a debate we have not had as a nation, and I think we're going to have.
And, of course, there are some things that are utterly appropriate to be private and corporate, like, you know, toasters and consumer products. You know,
consumer
if those were government, everybody would be Russia.
Well, that's true.
Or the Soviet Union.
If they were all manufactured by the government, you'd be the old Soviet Union. On the other hand, nobody wants to get electrocuted by a toaster.
Exactly.
So we've got to have some government regulation. We've seen a lot of tainted products coming into our country recently because our government oversight has fallen down.
Unfortunately, it's time to go. I can't believe it. Martha Burke is the author of Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista.